Foundations. Working at national, regional, and local levels, they are a force for good in American life. Hundreds of them giving millions of dollars in grants every year to protect the environment and improve health, to ensure arts, culture, and the humanities flourish in our communities, to help more people earn living wages, have food security, and adequate housing, and that students from preschool through college receive the great education they deserve. Education. It's a top priority for American philanthropy. In fact, foundations from coast to coast are engaged in efforts to address our nation's failure to deliver high-quality education and other supports to students who are most marginalized by the systems that work for those with power and privilege, but not very well for those who have had far less opportunity. Power and privilege. Foundations have a lot of both. Those residing in communities grappling daily with the nation's enduring legacy of systemic racism don't have nearly as much. Here's a question, then. Does philanthropy hold too much power and privilege to actually achieve equitable outcomes for the people it's intending to help? How can it wield its power and privilege for good? Let's find out. I'm David Obuchowski, and in this special episode of We Refuse to Lose from Education First, we're telling the story of power and privilege in philanthropy, and especially the dynamics between foundations and historically marginalized communities. And since we're on the subject of power and privilege, let me come right out and tell you that I've got both. I'm a white man. My life and opportunities have not been hindered by systemic racism. If anything, I've benefited from the way society is structured. So, why should I be the one to tell the story? Well, I'm not telling the story. Like you, I'm hearing the story, and I'm learning as I go. My own background is that of a documentarian. I was selected by Education First for this episode because I've produced stories that have explored difficult and complex issues. Just as I did in those stories, I am not here to tell you how it is. I am here to let other people tell you and me how it is. And those people are current and former funders who have decades of experience in philanthropy between them. They are also former school system leaders, lawyers, executives, and more. They are
Megan Jones,
Clotilde Perez Bodie D. Decker,
Jean-Claude Brizard,
Sarah Allen,
and finally,
Joe Scantleberry.
This podcast caps off We Refuse to Lose, a series produced by Education First, profiling early childhood to career community partnerships in Buffalo, Chattanooga, Dallas, the Rio Grande Valley, and Tacoma. These publications have presented the cross-sector work people are doing to address disparities in educational opportunity and outcomes for students from populations historically oppressed and marginalized. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, via their community investment team, has been supporting the P16 to workforce efforts in these communities since early 2019. As Jean-Claude Brizard, who launched and led this work until February 2021, describes,
what we did was to build a team called the Community Investment Team to really look at the ways in which our strategies were, the foundation's education strategy showed up in place, how folks responded to it, how some of it sustained, etc.
As a result of this effort, he says,
We begin to really understand that history matters, context matters, and how we looked at the education outcomes of a community really aligns with the history of the community.
As a national education strategy and policy organization that helps foundations, policymakers, and educators create more equitable and inclusive initiatives, Education First partnered with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation along the way. Its efforts to support these and other communities included the production of the We Refuse to Lose series, which wrapped up in September 2021 with a report to philanthropy, which can be found at werefusetolose.org. But this final installment of the series, a podcast, is unique from that report to philanthropy, as well as the profiles, because rather than examining each community or the initiative itself, we're exploring the dynamics between funders and those people and organizations they are funding. And it all starts with this very simple statement of fact.
You can't buy change with a grant.
That was Clotilde Perez Bodie de Decker. Clotilde knows all about how change happens. After all, she's
the president and CEO of the Community Foundation for Greater Buffalo.
And Buffalo has been a real success story. We'll touch on their success a bit later, but let's get back to that statement. You can't buy change with a grant. Especially when that change, those goals that grants are funding, are more equitable outcomes. But why? Isn't the purpose of a grant to affect change? So why can't change simply be funded into reality? Megan Jones, who is
president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Greater Chattanooga,
tells us one of those reasons.
Funders cannot build more equitable outcomes through inequitable processes or on relationships that are fundamentally inequitable.
Foundations have the power, they have the money, they have the platform. Communities historically marginalized don't. So how can fundamentally inequitable dynamics, such as those between funders and communities historically marginalized, be made more equitable? Jean-Claude Brizard recalls a piece of advice he once received from a former colleague.
In his advice to us in doing this work, he goes, funders have a habit of coming to community with their solutions and then saying, we have a solution. Do you have a problem? As if, you know, we've got the answer to your problems. Let us help you do this kind of work. That level of paternalism is never good and frankly will not spur the kind of success folks are looking for.
In addition to giving grants, large national funders can, well, they can listen.
The folks who are doing the work in the classrooms and schools, the policymakers, but also the grassroots, right, have to be at the same table in this idea of workshopping solutions collectively with a sort of an over-indexing on the expertise of the community has to be the way in which we do this. In fact, one colleague said to me, now funders need to be in the room, but in the back of the room. I think in some ways sort of gives you the visual of how this needs to be. The funder's job is to help catalyze the effort. The people who are on the front lines, the collective community has to be the ones, frankly, who are helping design with the content expertise, with the content experts, as well as the context experts in doing what needs to be done.
But also, they can support communities, not by prescribing what communities should do, but by supplying information, data, and research. Here's Sarah Allen, who's the Director of Early Learning and Pathways as part of the U.S. program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She says something foundations should be striving to supply is
explicit support for leaders and leadership development and networking and helping folks access different kinds of social capital is also sort of a bit more of an intangible but a really critical piece of shifting the power dynamics in the field.
In addition, a real effort must be made to ensure that those most proximate to the challenges use their voice to speak about what they see, what they need, especially when those people have different perspectives. Sarah Allen.
Even now, I've been working in education for 16 years. I don't bring the level of expertise in these issues and challenges that many of my colleagues do who have grown up in African-American and Latino communities or immigrant communities in the U.S. that have had lower levels of investment and resources. And so, you know, I can't be good at my job if I'm not paying attention to their perspectives because they know things I don't know. They have expertise I don't have. And so, you know, I think I'm in this process of kind of calibrating all the time, like, where is my more technocratic expertise helpful as someone who has, you know, good skills in strategy or planning or design of initiatives? You know, where's that valuable versus some of the other perspectives and capabilities that some of my colleagues can bring and our grantee partners can bring around, you know, what's going to really work in an environment? What's culturally relevant or respectful? You know, things that I, as a white person who's grown up in largely white environments and white institutions, I just don't have the same sensibility for.
Because really, when we're talking about educational outcomes, the more we listen, the more we learn that when it comes to the students who foundations are hoping to help, it involves a lot more than the schools they attend. As far as education goes, we've got to look at things outside of the school. What things?
Name your system.
That's Clotilde Perez-Bodie de Decker.
Right, because a child cannot learn if the child does not have housing stability, if the child doesn't have good nutrition, if the child doesn't have a safe environment in which you know, the child can grow.
Education is only one part of the system. And when it comes to the system itself, the thing that we all need to be talking about and address is systemic racism. This is not just a political issue. This is an educational issue. This is an issue for philanthropy. Here's Joe Scantlebury.
I think that many foundations believe that they are using their voice for good, but far too many choose to simply be funders. So we don't enter into the policy advocacy arena. We hesitate to take clear stances on things that we know from based on the information that we might be privileged to see and have come to us through from grantees as well as other sources. We don't take stances typically. We tend to. And by not taking a stance, you are taking a stance, which is an ironic thing.
This is something Joe Scantlebury knows a lot about, in part because of his time as Vice President for Program Strategies for the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, overseeing their place-based work. Prior to that, he was a Senior Program Officer for Policy Advocacy for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Joe takes no credit for it, but the Kellogg Foundation is one of those funders that is not beating around the bush when it comes to systemic racism. They talk about it unambiguously, and they work to address it. I asked Joe how they came to that and how other funders might also come to it. His answer was simply,
look at the facts, look at the data, and have the conversation and say why.
Why what specifically?
Why is it that I can go into almost any American town and discern where the black side is, where the white side is, or where the Latino side is, and where the white side is? Why can we discern that so easily?
So, where does philanthropy fit into dismantling the kind of structural racism that, as Joe says, is even visible in the buildings where we work and the streets we walk down? How much of a role do funders have in dismantling structural racism? And what mindset / behavior / postures that lead to more equitable practices should philanthropies adopt to achieve greater racial equity in communities? At the Gates Foundation, these external outcomes, like racial equity, start with internal work, as Sarah Allen explains.
I think it really starts with a set of strong commitments to the idea that if we're trying to support local communities that have been systemically disinvested in or have lacked resources or have had intentional systemic barriers put in their way to overcome those things, that we need to really deeply understand those conditions. We need to understand what has driven those barriers into place, whether it's policies or practices or systemic biases. And the only way we're going to actually understand those things well is to take time to deeply learn them and immerse ourselves in history to make sure that we are bringing a very diverse set of voices to the table to inform what we're doing, so that ultimately the things we decide to invest in and the way we go about investing in them actually deliver the impact for those local communities and for students and their families.
This may sound intuitive, but it's also a significant step forward. As Sarah says, when it comes to national foundations,
I think we have a long history of having a sort of technocratic approach that isn't necessarily fully acknowledging that history or that context, and then feeling disappointed that we aren't seeing the outcomes.
Joe Scantlebury agrees and shares some of his personal experience from working at the Kellogg Foundation.
I think at Kellogg, they were willing to look historically at what's happening in communities. They were willing to listen to communities as they shared their stories.
So I asked him, what advice do you have for national foundations committed to taking a similar journey?
One, I think you have to fund policy advocacy with your grantees. You just do. You just do. Because once you're in the policy space and you're explicit around issues of race and inequality, it comes up very quickly. The interests come up very, very quickly.
In addition to policy, he says, voting.
Right now, we're in a situation in this country where you literally are watching state legislatures try to reenact Jim Crow. Literally. And, you know, there may be all kinds of arguments made against it, you know, and said, no, we just want to prevent voter fraud. That didn't happen. But we saw it. You saw an insurrection come about because of those narratives that were created. So the commitment to voting is key, one, to whether or not you're going to maintain philanthropy as a sector, and two, whether or not you're going to maintain this democracy.
And for education funders in particular, here's something a little closer to schools and classrooms.
The recent noise over critical race theory I found fascinating because I can't think of a school district in the entire United States that is teaching critical race theory. Not one. But I do think the idea that there are people who would rather our children for yet another two generations stay ignorant about the diversity of who we are as Americans is an amazing thing. And our silence around it is equally fascinating.
But look, this need to reflect, to listen, this is not just something for influential national foundations. This needs to happen at every level. Clotilde Perez-Bodhi Dedecker at the Community Foundation for Greater Buffalo has been part of a movement, not just to act, but to listen. And a big part of that has been the Racial Equity Roundtable.
Yeah, so the Community Foundation convened the Racial Equity Roundtable. And what I can tell you, David, is that the work of the roundtable would not have been possible without national partners. Partners like the Kellogg Foundation and the Gates Foundation and the Casey Family Programs Foundation and on and on and on, right? National partners who came in and joined forces with our local coalition to help us advance race equity. That partnership, that national local partnership, was absolutely essential to standing up this robust effort of over 300 local partners representing the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit sector together working to advance race equity through targeted initiatives that fall into these two categories of building capacity of individuals and organizations to advance race equity, and then working together in a focused approach on specific systems in the areas of criminal justice, education, workforce, and inclusive workplaces.
I told you earlier that Buffalo is a success story, and in many ways, it is.
And the bottom line is that in 8 years, we have taken the high school graduation rate from 42% to 76%. So it's a very significant increase. And that has been a collective community effort. That has involved our city government, our county government, our elected officials at the local and the state level, private sector, who has funded significant scholarships to ensure that every graduate of the Buffalo Public and Charter Schools has their tuition guaranteed at a SUNY CUNY school, so our public university system, and then another 100 plus colleges and universities that are private across the country that have also joined this very robust partnership.
So how do you get to a place where so many different people and organizations at so many different levels are pitching in and working together? It's all about common ground. Megan Jones has become well-versed in finding that with donors.
One of the things that I've been using when I'm talking to people who may be resistant to the idea of structural racism, and I really learned this from reading again and again Ibrahim Kendi's book, is talking about this idea of, do you believe that all people are inherently equal? And most people will say, well, yes, you know, even in the eyes of our creator, right, that all people are inherently equal. Okay. Well, and now let's look at all these statistics across these systems. So maternal health, poverty rates, and we have these locally, these statistics. If we are created equal, but across all of these systems, people of color are experiencing worse outcomes, there has to be something else at play.
One of the things that makes what she's saying so powerful is that it really demonstrates how much further we have to go. That there are still so many people who don't believe or who don't want to believe in structural racism just goes to show where we are in the process of dismantling it. We can't fix what we won't even admit is real. But perhaps we're at an inflection point with the outcry over the murder of George Floyd, the efforts to prevent voter suppression, and even the continuing investigations into the January 6th insurrection.
Yeah, I think it's not a simple answer. I do feel like in the last few years, and accelerated by the pandemic, accelerated by the racial justice reckoning and the events of last year, certainly leaders in philanthropy have deepened their focus, their introspection, their engagement with the field and with each other around how to shift practices to ultimately, as I said before, you know, have much more clarity around how we will in fact be able to, you know, see the change that we seek happen in the world. And that's going to, it's requiring some different ways of operating. So I do think that is real. And it's pretty sustained and it's going on many, many different funder organizations. So is that an inflection point for philanthropy? Well, maybe. Certainly it's some progress. Whether we're at an inflection point around redesigning systems to eliminate the barriers that have been in place for decades in education and economic mobility, that remains to be seen. You know, it's hard to know. It's one of these confusing moments where there are both headwinds and tailwinds crashing into each other.
There are many folks who are afraid to talk about this, who are not yet talking about this in earnest, who are not yet having the very difficult conversations about our history, how we were designed and built, and what is happening in our schools and classrooms and community. That would continue to change, but the momentum, the fire has to be to maintain, we have to keep it lit. We've got to keep talking about this. Then ultimately, I think we'll reach a point where we can begin to talk about the other side of this issue.
If we're able to make this a moment, a real moment of change, then it's time to be brave. But bravery doesn't just come from within. It comes from the people and organizations around you. It comes from listening to stories from those with lived experiences. It comes from boards and national funders, not only making a commitment to create equitable outcomes, but to find their voice and lend their support. For Megan Jones, this support has been key.
One of the things that I think has allowed me to have those conversations and really walk with courage is the support of the board. And that has been critical. This board made a commitment to equity in our new strategic plan and adopted a new vision for the foundation that included more equitable outcomes for the community. And so having that board commitment really gives us as staff the courage and the support to have sometimes difficult conversations.
And Megan adds,
the board realized that taking a stance around racial equity could mean that there were donors that no longer wanted to have a fund here. We hoped that wouldn't be the case, but it could happen. And they made that decision because they knew we were on the right path and we were responding to what we'd heard from the community of where we need to be focused. And that gave us courage at the staff level, or maybe not courage, to give us support. But we haven't lost donors. We've had donors engage us around conversations. I want to understand what you're doing, or this is different than how I think, but we've been really fortunate that we can engage at that level.
This recognition that there could be blowback or controversy, but that's okay because it's the right path, can be a tough path to walk, unless there are many others on that path with you, and especially if the others on that path are nationally known entities.
In foundations, there's a tendency to want to, first of all, protect the corpus, right? Protect the investment. And so therefore, do nothing that's going to draw criticism and undermine the organization's reputation, undermine its stability. You're in a sort of a do-no-harm space when you're the steward and leadership, either at the board level or at the officer level of a foundation. That said, these are boundaries and limits created by ourselves. We don't have to be bound in those ways typically. We actually can be more expansive, more thoughtful, more bold. And in fact, a lot of what we're asked to do is to have the courage to take on the risk for a conversation. Now, we have to have a calculated risk, right? You have to be thoughtful about what you're doing and how you're doing it, because you don't want to create harm when you're trying to remedy your problem. But candidly, I think it's a leadership issue. I think it's a leadership issue that I think we have the ability to address, but it really takes real thoughtful sharing and collaboration, but more importantly, a willingness to listen to the field, right? Listen to the people you're seeking to serve. Listen to the grantees who are on the front line doing this work, right? And help them inform your work. And very often we tend to stand behind our grantees and expect them to be the voices on many things, and they are. And, you know, that's your primary responsibility, to move the resources into the hands of grantees and partners. But if you think about your role as an institution, your voice counts too.
Listening, speaking. Clotilde Perez-Bodie de Decker believes there's a step further, particularly for white people who think of themselves as allies.
I think the time has come where we need to get off the bench as an ally and get in the space of advocate and owning the issues and being part of the solutions, actively engaged as an advocate. So I think it's, you know, the ownership of an issue and the active participation in coalitions that are advancing the change you want to see happen is really critical and important. And I'm seeing that across the country, that folks are really coming in service of these very important social agendas, certainly in advancing race equity and advocating for the change that we want to see. So I think it's the word advocate for me is more active than ally.
In a world of allies, we can be something more. We need to be more, because racial justice isn't just around the corner. It's not a matter of just a few more grants.
I think we're still climbing the mountain in many ways. I think those of us, again, going back to the foundations and those of us who have the bullhorn, we've got to keep pushing folks up this hill. But I don't believe yet we've reached the mountaintop.
Thank you to our guests, Sarah Allen, Jean-Claude Brizard, Clotilde Perez-Bodie de Decker, Joe Scantlebury, and Megan Jones. Learn more about the topics they discussed by reading the We Refuse to Lose report to philanthropy and community profiles at werefusetolose.org or on the Education First website. I'm David Obuchowski. Thank you for listening.